Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Blind people punished for the crimes of the super rich, for whom £1 million a year still isn't enough. George Osborne's economy is sliding into the ditch, as it is now clear none of his austerity measures are going to work. The ratings agency is also poised to downgrade Britain too. So, this week, two expert guests, not official spokespeople, but with proven independent minds. Take a warts and all look at Britain's finances and give their own version of Plan B, the plan we hope will be put in place before wages for all but the super rich are forced down even further, before we end up like Italy, Spain and poor old Greece. Well, they've had enough practice, these bankers. They gave Europe and the US now the same treatment that they meted out to African countries with structural adjustment from the International Monetary Fund over the last 30 years or so. Plus, we have Martin Summers' weekly take on the tour of the world's hotspots. Martin, I think that's where we'll start this week. First of all, forget Oscar Pistorius. I mean, everyone's talking about that this week. But another murder or death, possible suicide, about 9/11. This is a guy called Philip Marshall, one of the leading figures in an organisation called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. Now, can you just tell us a bit about this case?
Well, I mean, he was found dead with his family, and of course it's been suggested that he shot himself, killed his family and shot himself. But Wayne Madsen, who's another ex-intelligence agent who blogs on the internet and people can check him, he's looked into it, and he's saying, I'm 100% certain that the guy was assassinated.
Now, this happened at the end of January. The guy's name again, Philip Marshall. I mean, he'd been involved in intelligence work, in doing things like smuggling stuff for the Central Intelligence Agency, as a pilot, moving things around the world secretly, including he was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. I mean, that was a massive scandal, loads of crooks involved in that. Why on earth should we trust what Philip Marshall has to say?
Well, I mean, he's an insider. I mean, he was an insider in the Iran-Contra affair in the sense that he was one of the pilots that were flying drugs into the US and arms out of the US on behalf of the CIA. And, of course, because he was involved in those things, he later had a twinge of conscience and started to grass it up, which probably explains why he's no longer with us.
Now, why is it that we've not heard anything much about this case then? I mean, is it just generally that when there's a bit of people are scratching their heads? I mean, with the Oscar Pistorius case, equally, no one's really quite sure what happened, but it's a massive profile case. This guy here and this particular incident, this story, even though it's potentially incredible that a death squad has actually gone and killed this guy and tried to make it look like suicide, along with his two sons and dog, that there's no real discussion about it in the mainstream press at all.
Well, the thing with Pistorius, of course, is that people know who he is because he's a celeb, because he was, did stuff at the Olympics, and therefore people are supposed to know who he is. But it is rather typical of the values of the mainstream media that they will big up what is essentially a personal tragedy, whatever's happened there in the Pistorius case, and ignore something much more serious where it looks like the government may be going around bumping off its critics. But, of course, that doesn't happen in free societies like the United States, does it? I'm afraid it does.
Well, why all the sensitivity around 9/11 then? Because this is very much connected with that. He's basically saying that the official story of the September the 11th attacks is a load of nonsense.
Well, as are many US military figures like General Stubblebine, or Russian military figures like General Ivashov, who was in command of the Russian armed forces on the day, or Alan Sobroski, who used to head up the US Army War College. I mean, the fact of the matter is, those who use the internet, who go to Veterans Today, for example, or My Catbird Seat, you'll find plenty of ex-military and intelligence officers who are quite convinced that 9/11 was an inside job. Military officers for 9/11 Truth. I would encourage people to look at that. They'll see hundreds of US military officers who are absolutely convinced that the government were behind what happened. And of course, these guys are trained in understanding these things, so it's not that surprising that they've seen through it. Well, but of course, it's very dangerous to open your mouth.
Well, you can hear Philip opening his mouth and closing it quite a lot on a former guest on the Coast to Coast show, which is a big, I think it's a AM medium wave radio talk show in the United States, with George Norrie. Marshall's biography for that site says Marshall has researched 30 years of covert government activities, a revolving door of Wall Street tricksters, media moguls and their well-funded politicians into every branch of the US government. After 9/11, Marshall's led a comprehensive 10-year study into the tactical plan used by the 9/11 hijackers and is the leading aviation expert on the September 11th attack. Same bio also describes Marshall as a former government special activities contract pilot, the leading aviation expert on the September 11th attack. I mean, you would have thought that this would have made the news.
Well, I mean, as you know, there's a conspiracy of silence surrounding this. We're all supposed to forget about it now, except when it matters to the powers that be. But increasingly, people around the world, not Middle England and Middle America, but you know, people around the world, in you know, the Indian subcontinent, Latin America, it's pretty common knowledge what happened, and of course it wasn't what the government claimed.
Okay, also this week, Bilderberg attendee Amazon, when I say Amazon, that's the company, they sent a representative to these Bilderberg conferences, which are were set up by a former Nazi SS officer in 1954, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, and take place in secret every year, either in Europe or on the other side of the Atlantic in the United States. And the Bilderberg attendee Amazon used the neo-Nazi guards to keep immigrant workforce under control in Germany. The internet giant investigates abuse claims by foreign workers in its German warehouses. Amazon's at the centre of a deepening scandal in Germany as the online shopping giant faced claims it employed security guards with neo-Nazi connections to intimidate its foreign workers. Germany's ARD television channel made the allegations in a documentary about Amazon's treatment of more than 5,000 temporary staff from across Europe to work in its German packing and distribution centres. The company is called Hess Security, and the German TV programme was saying it's an allusion to Adolf Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess. It's alleged its director was a man named only as UWEL, if that's a name, who associated with football hooligans and convicted neo-Nazis who were known to the police. Martin, this is pretty shocking for Amazon, isn't it?
It is, but it's even more shocking, of course, that West German, or the German intelligence services, for years were covering up a neo-Nazi squad which was actually assassinating Turkish citizens of Germany, and in fact they were covering it up and investigating it as if it was some kind of struggle within the Turkish community. And it turned out that all of these people, most of them sort of shop owners and so on, were being assassinated by neo-Nazis, which were being covered up by the German intelligence services. And again, the German intelligence is a part of NATO, part of the Gladio structure, and in fact the fount of much terrorism in Western Europe since the 1940s.
Hess Security did not respond to the allegations made by ARD. So, I mean, ultimately, this is a very, very wealthy, powerful business, Amazon. Many, many people trust it. I certainly didn't. I mean, I've been buying things from Amazon also. I didn't realise that they had these kind of guys doing security guards. I mean, the thing is with a lot of online businesses now, which is the way things are going, particularly with the rents in the high street being unaffordable for small businesses, online businesses don't have to have those same sort of overheads. The trouble is, of course, that we're going into a world where we don't actually meet anybody face to face, where many of our transactions are taking place.
Well, we were talking about national socialism in the first hour, and of course what actually happens is that business interests are quite willing to use neo-Nazis in order to discipline their own workforces. This is exactly the same as what happened in Germany in the 1930s. And of course, the big industrialists, the Amazons of their day, saw the Nazis as a means of disciplining their own workforces, terrifying them, making them sure they didn't join unions, and so on and so forth. it's history redux, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, many of the big German manufacturing firms like Siemens, Krupps, etc. In fact, many of the companies that we would know today, for example, Volkswagen back in those days, became Nazified businesses. They had a big ceremony outside the headquarters. The swastika would go up all around the building and pictures of Hitler. I don't think that's quite happened at Amazon yet, but I mean, are you saying that there's some sort of similarity there?
Well, I mean, the point I'm making is that businesses have their own interests, which are to do with making a profit, and they then don't care that much how they make that profit. And if this company, you know, this neo-Nazi security company can terrify these foreign workers for you, well, it's just a marriage of convenience, isn't it? And that's exactly how Hitler ingratiated himself with the industrialists in the 30s. And I'm afraid that's where we're going, is that kind of struggle.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Revealed, UK sells arms to Sri Lanka's brutal regime. This is a great little investigative report by The Independent beginning of this week. The government database shows that sales continue despite a litany of human rights abuses. Britain selling millions of pounds worth of small arms and ammunition to Sri Lanka despite the country's terrible human rights record. Figures taken from the government's own database show how the authorities in Colombo have gone into a buying spree of British small arms and weaponry worth at least £3 million. Some of the items sold to Sri Lanka include pistols, rifles, assault rifles, body armour, combat shotguns, despite the Foreign Office still classifying the South Asian nation as a country of concern for rights abuses. The sales indicate how far President Mahinda Rajapaksa, Rajapaksa's government has been welcomed back into the international fold by Britain despite the behaviour of his armed forces during the brutal last few months of the 2009 civil war. The conflict was a culmination of a 30-year conflict with the violent Tamil Tiger separatists and resulted in the deaths, the deaths of between 60,000 and 100,000 Tamils over a four-month period, most of whom were civilians. Now, we are, this guy's now back in, I mean, he came for a dinner with the Queen last year as well, didn't he? What on earth are we doing selling arms to these lunatics? I mean, I wouldn't say he's a lunatic. The guy should be behind bars, certainly not being wined and dined by Her Majesty.
Well, and also, I mean, £3 million worth of arms, you seem to think, well, is it worth ruining this country's reputation for the sake of 3 million lousy squid? I mean, you have to ask. But, of course, Britain's got linkages with all of these kind of dictators. Look at Bahrain, for example, where we are right behind the repressive regime backed up by the Saudis, which is crushing the democracy movement there. Sri Lanka, we've got is the case in front of us. Ultimately, basically, Britain is losing its reputation, if you've ever had one, for being a country of fairness and decency. And of course, once you've lost it, you can't regain it that easily.
Yes, just repeat that figure. Between 60 and 100,000 Tamils over a four-month period, most of whom were civilians, were killed by the Sri Lankan army. I suppose that was their way of saying, right, that's it, we don't want a civil war anymore. And what they started doing basically was using the armed forces and surveillance, some of which is provided by the West from satellites and this kind of thing, to simply massacre so many civilians that the Tamils just simply gave up because they realised that, if they didn't, that there would be no Tamils left in Sri Lanka.
Well, if you know, this is the Channel 4 documentaries about this that were shown last year. I mean, basically, they encourage civilians to go to various what they call protected areas. If you go to these protected areas, we won't be bombing you there. And once they got all the civilians in the protected areas, they had them all in the right place to assess, to kill them all, and they did. And I'm afraid that is the way it played out.
Well, this is a former British colony, isn't it? Which is why I suppose this is such an important issue. Is this the way we treat our former colonial subjects? Is by supplying arms to the most brutal dictator we can find in that area?
Well, it was Liam Fox and Mr. Werity were out there, weren't they? Peddling weaponry to their chums in Colombo. I mean, Britain has basically got a reputation around the world for supporting this kind of thing and trying to profit from it. And, I'm afraid that is the way we're seen in many parts of the world, and it's not a very pretty sight, is it?
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
an excellent documentary on Russia Today last weekend. Well, it excited me anyway, because it's the first time I'd seen such a brilliant little bit of an insight into the way that the EU really works. And as the Corporate Europe Observatory, which is used to be a little Dutch NGO, they've now actually moved to Brussels so they can keep a sharper eye on what happens in Brussels, discovered. Actually, what happens is that this little group called called the European Roundtable of Industrialists are the people that actually decide on our new European laws. Absolutely gobsmacking to see this incredibly super wealthy group of chief executives from the biggest countries, biggest companies right across Europe, just get together, decide what new laws they want, draft a few of their staff to draft the laws and some lawyers. They were produced by the European Roundtable of Industrialists and then just appeared magically by the European Commission. A cut and paste job, Martin. Literally, these big companies saying what the law's going to be, and a week later, that law appears, endorsed by the European Commission, and is sent on its way through the European Parliament for the MEPs to vote for. I mean, it just seems incredible to me that all the new laws are being drafted by people like this, just simply heads of big business.
And it's not just true of the EU, it's also true of the British government, the US government, individual governments that are not part of the EU. The fact of the matter is that the financial sector and the multinationals dominate the political process. We don't live in a democracy, really. We live in an oligarchy, and that's just the reality of it.
Okay, well, let's have a little listen now to a clip from The Brussels Business, because that's the title of the documentary. I suppose the thing to point out here is that the same guy you hear who set up the European Roundtable of Industrialists is a guy called Mr. Davignon, who's also the chairman of the notorious former Nazi-founded organisation, the Bilderbergs, founded by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, former SS officer, former member of the Nazi Party from World War II. And he's now, this guy Davignon is now or at least was until recently, I'm not sure if he is right this minute, the chairman of this Bilderberg conference. So let's have a listen to him now.
From the Commission, the member of the Commission who was really keen was a Belgian called Stevie Davignon. He had diplomatic and business background, and he could see the need. He said, if I want to talk to European industry, who do I talk to?
What I found out when I was a commissioner for industry, that there was an insufficient contact in between the commission and the economic operators. The relation which existed was a relation with the federations of industry at, I would say, an official level, but not at the level of the people who were responsible for individual businesses. And I felt that we were missing this. And so we decided to set up a group of industries, which later became the ERT, so as to have the capacity to listen to the CEOs.
The Agnellis, who ran Fiat in Italy. There was Wissedecker, who ran Philips in the Netherlands. There was Per Gillenhammer, who ran Volvo in Sweden. People from Siemens and the big German chemical companies, and the French and the Spaniards, and then the British. A small number of people who ran the biggest companies in Europe and were ready to talk about big policy issues with those people who were in charge of the European government machine.
The European government machine, Martin. But you're saying it's really just the same everywhere now, that ordinary people don't get any kind of say, or ordinary MPs, in drafting new laws.
Well, I mean, just think about the amount of resources these kind of industrialists have. And, you know, they don't leave it to chance. They lobby in the US, I believe in Washington, there are thousands and thousands of lobbyists representing various industrial and other commercial interests. And effectively, they write the laws because, the legislators haven't got time to read through all the detail. They require other people to tell them what's going on, and they basically allow themselves to be dictated to by business interests. And until we reform the political system, that's going to be the way of it, whether it's in the EU, the US, US, Britain, or wherever.
I'm going to be a bit cheeky now and say it's not reforming the political system, it's also reforming the financial system. Because,
indeed,
of course, it's the a lot of people are the super rich that we'll be talking about today that finance the political parties that have become so tainted in that way. Anyway, just had a chat to Ian Fraser, who we'd hoped to have on the programme today, his wife. He's been called away to pick up some kids, so he hasn't been able to actually come on this week, so we'll have him hopefully next week. Martin, final story going around the world this week. Senator Lindsey Graham says the United States drones have killed nearly 5,000 people for the first time ever. A senior US senator publicly announced the number of victims of America's ever-expanding drone war, and of course Britain has got a expanding drone war too, and apparently it's even bigger than some independent researchers have suggested. Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, put a number on the US growing tally of kills called by Uncle Sam's arsenal of drones on Tuesday this week while speaking to constituents at Eastleigh Rotary Club in Eastleigh, South Carolina. We've killed 4,700, the Council for Foreign Relations says. And that's interesting that she actually is quoting figures from the Council on Foreign Relations, which is itself a rather dodgy group, rather very close to the Bilderbergers themselves, which is a sort of private lobbying cartel of American big business, Martin.
Indeed, and the vast majority of those people, they accept, I believe, that none of them were militants. I mean, they say somebody's a militant if they are of military age when they die, but even including that, I think there are hundreds, at least hundreds of children included in that figure. And I'm not going back to our first story about the suicide bombers in Birmingham. I wouldn't justify what they were doing at all if they were engaged in attempting to carry out suicide bombings. But if you've got a situation where thousands of civilians are being whacked mercilessly by US and British military forces, people have got to expect a bit of comeback, haven't they, at the end of the day?
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Yes, tough words, Martin. Anyway, Mohamed Rafiq was one on the staff of the Bank of England in the 1980s, knows how it works from the inside out. Unlike the public faces of the bank now, he's prepared to talk about it in honest language, which helps rather than hinders our understanding. And I spoke to him in South London earlier this week.
My name is Mohamed Rafiq. I've been working in central banking and finance since about 1985. Of course, being a banker, I won't give you precise numbers, I'll give you approximations till such time as we've got a contract in place, and then you find out the real cost.
Okay, so but how did you get into, and you actually were a permanent employee at the Bank of England in the 1980s?
I was at the front ends of the Bank of England, known as the discount houses. We went through the big change process from the old manual paper systems, when a coupon really was a coupon, a piece of paper that did the rounds, got various stamps on it, and back then we would ring up banks to find out if a stamp was genuine or not, because you could fake a stamp with a potato. You know, I mean, it was that kind of security that went on back then. And we digitized, as part of the Big Bang process, was the digitization of all these traditional financial and banking products and shares, all these things that used to be certificates that are now digital. We went through the process of digitizing all of that.
So you're responsible for this electronic money, but you talk there about the front end. You sound like a cashier, but that's not it, is it? What's the front end and what was the back end of the Bank of England?
What I mean by the front end of the Bank of England is market facing. So it's still wholesale markets. We were still selling to the banks, but we were selling the UK Treasury bills and the UK gilts. People have to buy them from somewhere. Back then, you didn't buy direct from a central bank. You bought through one of the bank's discount houses, their licensed discount houses. They, in turn, would buy them directly from the Bank of England at an auction process. So as the front end, what I mean by that is that we were facing the rest of the world, selling off the gilts and the treasury bills for and on behalf of the Bank of England.
So the old paper system, did people have to physically come and pick up these various share certificates and bonds and this kind of thing? And how did that transfer over to the electronic version?
Yeah, absolutely. There used to be guys in the city known as messengers. These guys went running from one institution to the next with satchels on their shoulders carrying bearer certificates, and that was the reason you needed bearer certificates, because it had to be the owner who redeemed them on maturity to go and collect the cash, because there was no other way of tracing them before the digital age. You turn up there with it in your hand, and if you set fire to it or it gets damaged or something like that, you've lost the money. I mean, it was very serious.
Did the messengers ever get lost on the way or disappear off abroad?
There were a few incidents where, for instance, in the snow, a messenger slipped and lost one of his satchels. That got handed in, and it had a large amount of paper money in it, as it's known. There is another instance where a messenger who heard some bad news delayed lodging his certificates with the bank till after 3 p.m, which meant that they didn't accrue any interest for that particular evening, and the amount of money that was lost in overnight meant that none of the messengers got a Christmas bonus that year.
I think many people would agree with you that economics is very difficult to understand and see through. Do you think that's deliberate, and that's what it really means, isn't it? But blinded by verbosity.
Absolutely. I mean, the economics does not hold any solutions for central banking or the banking system or for banks. It is not really possible to study central banking. The understanding that is taught in academia through economic circles has got very little to do with the practical reality on the ground. And that is simply because it's, you know, as the Americans would say, a bum steer. If people don't know what the actual subject is and the subject matter, they can talk till the cows come home about anything else. They can't fix anything because their core understanding is wrong.
Now, I think you paint the picture of a rather more of a sort of utilitarian, if we can say that, a kind of public utility version of the Bank of England back in the 80s. What's changed?
One of the things that we did in capturing the old paper system and looking at what bits of information were on what bits of paper and putting it all onto a huge grand design board and looking where this information flowed is we digitized that process and the information. What we didn't do was ask the question, do we need to do it like this? Does DP, as it was then known, data processing, now IT, information technology, does IT give us a new way of doing this? So even without the conspiracy theory element, which isn't a theory, it's a conspiracy fact, as I was describing the difference between the understandings there, and that's carefully managed because the people who understand what's going on pass that on an intergenerational basis, and it's a very limited need-to-know basis.
But it sounds almost like a cult.
Yeah, you could say it was almost like that. It was a money cult. I mean, these people had been earning from these processes for generations. In the same way somebody might be a rope maker or a candlestick maker or a smith of some description, these people passed on from one generation to the next so that their children got this instant leg in. The institutions that I worked for instance, were purely old Etonian. So if you didn't have the old school tie, and everybody knows this, this is not a theory, this is fact, historical fact. If you didn't have the school tie, you didn't get on the board. It was that simple. It was got nothing to do with capability or qualification. It was completely a privileged hierarchy.
Back in the 1970s and 80s, I mean, in the 80s, and when we started dropping off from the idea of full employment, at some point, Britain has gone from being a country where money actually serves the population and serviced the nation to a point where we're now feeling that actually we are serving the money system. At what point did that happen?
Well, I think it's always been like that. I think that after the Second World War, they lifted the yoke slightly. But if you go back Second World War, you don't have to go back that far to find children cleaning the inside of chimneys, etc. So there was a system of slavery in this country that, although we like to look at slavery systems in other parts of the world, slavery did exist here. We had child slave labour. There were unions that fought against that to try and get some kind of equality in life. We kind of take all of those fights for granted now that went on back then and think that this system, which is slowly, insidiously seeping its way into becoming the master of our lives, is something new. It's actually something returning, and hence the old mantra, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. If we study the history of this system, we'll see very clearly that all that's happening is a repeat of what's happened previously. It's been digitized, it's sold in a different way, where it's marketed, and we're made to feel comfortable about it and made to feel that it's the right and proper thing, but actually it isn't. The whole thing needs challenging from the root up.
That's a challenging question in a way, and I'd like to put it to you. If you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes now, without David Cameron or a Prime Minister breathing down your neck, what kind of decisions would you be making about ways to put the country back on track, where we do have a financial system that operates in a sort of boring utility that just makes sure that everybody has a job, and that when they do, that they're getting a fair reward for it?
I think that the thing to understand is that there is a massive disconnect between the banking system and the central bank and the banks. Those three things are, although they're interlinked, they are separate, and they have nothing to do with the economy. Absolutely nothing to do with the economy, other than the measure of monetary supply, the money in supply, is an economic statistic. It's a fairly small number of statistics which are quoted within the economic paradigm. You know, when you look at a country and everything that happens within its economy, M0 through M4 is just a small set of numbers. But actually, that's done on purpose, because they don't want people looking at what goes on beyond that. So if we were to say, what would we be changing? I would be changing it not as an economist, and I would not be really making that many changes to the economy. What I would be doing would be changing the way the central bank worked, the way that our borrowing worked as a nation, the way that our money goes into supply as a nation, and I would also be looking at redesigning the banking system so that we're never in a situation of needing to bail it out ever again. Well, there are several ways that this can be done, and it's all about sequence. What you have is the where we are now, and if this were a project, we have the TOM, the target operating model. What I just described there is the target operating model that we need to get to. As with all projects, there's several stages that you can go through to get to that final point.
Well, let's you be our project manager then and take us through that, because I think we get a lot of criticism of the existing system, but very little explanation of what could be a plan B. So be our project manager.
Okay, well, at the moment we are project managing. I'll give two examples, Iceland and Greece. We look at two countries which both came croppers as a result of overborrowing, overleverage of the banks, and a total failure. What we have is a completely different approach by the people. And this is what's crucial here, by the people and not the governments. It's not something that the governments did in Iceland, it's actually something the people did. The people marched on their government and their banks, put them in court, found them guilty, and put them in jail. So the first thing they did was say, you are the cause of the problem, therefore you cannot be part of the solution, and in fact we find what you've done to have been criminal activity. So they were found guilty as criminals and jailed. In Greece, the Greek people have been told, in spite of their uprising and their protestations, you must take the medicine which is being dished out. You will stand by the government, you will stand by the banks, and you will take the measures, the so-called austerity measures, which is in itself a farcical word to use, because they're poverty measures. Austerity, just to open a small segue bracket here, austerity is something that you do on an individual basis. It's a self-discipline. I'm an austere person implies self-discipline. If I take money off somebody to the extent that he loses his home and has to sleep on the pavement, that is not somebody that we call austere. He is a victim of circumstance through external forces which have forced him into that position. So the Greeks have poverty measures which are being enforced on them through G10, certainly through the European Union, as things which they have to undertake and measures they have to do. We have a little bit of independence in the UK at this stage, which means, can we operate more like Iceland than Greece? The answer to that is yes. If we wanted to, we could say, well, let's have a look at the activities that have been going on and act accordingly. Now, anybody who follows the news recently will see nobody has gone to jail over LIBOR. The LIBOR fraud is probably the single biggest fraud that's been perpetrated on mankind in terms of the amount of nominal value that's behind it. It's probably 70 to 80 trillion pounds, and the interest on that amount through these derivative contracts that have got a sterling LIBOR leg on those contracts, out of a total of $700 trillion worldwide. So we're talking about 14-15% of contracts, something like that, have got a sterling leg. Every single one of those perpetrators should be in jail. They are fraudsters. They've committed fraud on an enormous scale. So the first thing that we have to do to change things is to start calling a spade and not an implement for the rearrangement of earth and blah, blah, blah.
But isn't there a bit of confusion over whether it's the actual traders themselves or the people on the boards of those banks that committed LIBOR fraud?
The fact of the matter is that they employed fraudsters, and if they didn't know fraud was going on in their banks, then they're incompetent and need dismissing as well. The fact of the matter is that in order to clean this house out, it's a very old saying, if you don't learn from these simple idioms in history, you're always going to fail. A new broom sweeps clean. You've got to go in there and clean out the house. The people who made this mess cannot fix it. That's the first thing that the people of Iceland got right. The second thing they then did was say, we will not be held hostage to this debt. We are not paying this debt. We are walking away from it. You can do what you want to our national credit rating. You can call us defaulters. You can call us whatever you want. This debt was taken on by these criminals. It's their responsibility. Because their actions were criminal, we don't accept any liability. So the debt was then written off. So the people of Iceland are now starting with a clean slate. The reason that the people of Greece are committing suicide to the extent that they are, that they're suffering this enormous misery, is because people are not writing off the debt. They shouldn't have got there. The people who borrowed that national debt were criminals. There's something like 360 billion euros worth of debt for an economy that was 25% of that. It should never have been allowed to go over the 1-to-1 ratio. Bottom line, those people who did that, put them in jail and just write the debt off. That's the first stage.
You're actually implying that it's the people's responsibility, but actually people have protested both in Iceland and in Greece. Isn't it really more to do with the size of the country and the accessibility of the politicians and the government?
No, I think that when we say the people, we have to ask ourselves, do the police consider themselves to be people? Does the state prosecutor consider himself to be one of the people? These people committed criminal acts. If the police and the state prosecutor have sufficient grounds to consider someone's committed a crime, you get them arrested. It's that simple. So we have to now ask the question, what kind of government and what kind of policing is in place where acts which are clearly defined as criminal acts, same in the UK, these are being smoothed over by government in the UK. LIBOR, everybody engaged in that is a fraudster. And if people at the top knew that their lackeys were up to this on their swaps desks, then they are equally guilty. And then we have to ask the question, well, you didn't know it was going on, so that's negligence. They're guilty of one crime or the other. They took on a huge amount of money belonging to the British people and international people for that matter, and they paid handsomely for that responsibility. Now, to behave criminally on top of that is a crime. And just because they got smart suits and just because they make lots of money does not make them immune to criminality. Until such time as this country turns round and starts arresting these criminals and putting them in jail, you're not going to change anything.
Is it possible that the City of London Police, which is a special jurisdiction all of its own, is kind of in the pocket of the city and that they are rather too pally and they know they're not going to be arrested by the City Police?
Well, the City of London Police always look for heads of security jobs at the time that they retire within the banks. So they're always overly pally in that particular neck of the woods, unfortunately. But as we know, the police and Murdoch's media were overly pally. This seems to be a common problem within the police forces generally, that they themselves don't have enough independent review and control. But the point is that in the court of public opinion, We, the people, have seen criminals being forgiven their criminality for paying an upfront fine. These people are not going to jail. What kind? Just very simply, let's just ask ourselves, what kind of message does that send out to anybody else engaged in banking activity and financial activity that's thinking, yeah, the bank will pay a fine, I don't do any time, what's to stop me? There's no moral hazard. There's no downside to taking that kind of a criminal risk, so why not do it? So the first thing we have to do is stop talking about regulation and stop talking about financial crime, because financial crime is the sort of thing that if somebody in your local branch stole £50 out of the safe, would be sacked, and we'd expect them to be vilified in the media and all of these kinds of things. We'd expect their name to be mud. But if the crime's big enough, the government is papering over it.
But it seems to me what you're saying then essentially is, looking at Iceland and Greece and Britain, is that really this is about policing. What about the Serious Fraud Office? If the City of London police aren't going to arrest anybody, what about them in Scotland Yard?
This is a political will that politicians are overriding the behaviour of people whose job it is to detect crime and to enforce procedures against crime. Somebody somewhere is smoothing all of that over. We could look, for instance, at Hector Sants, the recent head of the FSA, who's now leaving to become head of compliance at Barclays Bank. Managed to get himself a nice £3 million a year package. This was the man who a couple of years ago was telling everybody that he was on the warpath against overpaid banking directors. Here he is with a £3 million a year package, 750,000 basic, plus. Can't help but wonder if the man's not been bought off for making sure that the FSA doesn't insist the police prefer charges as well. Looks like a payoff to me.
Given that that's really essentially where you're coming from, that people do have to actually go to jail, can you see that happening here in Britain?
I think that there will come a stage where the people will have had enough, because the other thing is, what do we need to do to change it? Well, there's a series of measures, and as I say, for me, those are the first steps, because that shows serious intent. By arresting people and putting them in jail for the crimes they've committed, what we're actually saying is, we won't stand for this behaviour in future. Anybody that does this in future can expect jail. That's a great deterrent in itself, and it's a commitment to future generations that we want behaviour with integrity and honesty with inside of our financial dealings. Without that message going ahead, we can't change. If we can't change, where do we go? The answer is Greece. We will end up in a Greek situation. That is, the medicine, and let's just, you know, again, common sense hat on now, Tony. 6 years they've had. Northern Rock blew up 6 years ago, 2007. We're into 2013, 6 years. All of the quantitative easing, all of the different measures, everything that they've done, the lowering of interest rates, the doing of this, the doing of that, all the buttons and knobs and whistles at their controls that they've managed to turn, in 6 years, the situation is still getting progressively worse. Anybody, you don't have to be Albert Einstein to realise it means that what they're doing isn't working. If it hasn't worked for 6 years, it's not going to work over the next 6 years. So this is simply a pain game. The British public will end up in similar levels of pain to the people of Greece. We will end up there because that's where this road goes. Nothing that they do is going to alter that course. They need to behave in a different way and to press different buttons and to come up with different solutions to these problems. So I believe, ultimately, that level of pain, when we've lost enough jobs, when we've lost enough retail, when we've lost enough manufacturing, when people have had enough, we might get to a Jarrow March type situation. But unfortunately, we're in a situation where rather than people being proactive, they're going to be reactive. And that's the problem. People who've been talking in advance about this, have been trying to warn where this is heading, they're proactive and saying, let's act now before we end up in this train crash. In the meantime, a lot of other people say, well, I'll wait for the train crash and then worry about the fact that the train's crashed. Not a helpful attitude, but that's the dilemma that we're really facing, I believe.
So will we end up with a sort of elite of super rich and a kind of almost Victorian or medieval underclass of people who are simply dying?
Well, we're almost there anyway. I mean, we already have a super powerful financial elite. That's a reality. They are an elite who, as I've just been describing, consider themselves to be outside the law. They behave with impunity. They commit criminal acts for which the rest of us go to jail and they don't. Anybody that can't see that as a two-tier system is utterly blind, and they're wasting their time listening to this radio programme.
So, I mean, it sounds like the law of the jungle. Isn't there a sort of fascistic, I mean, I hesitate to use the word, but aspect to this sort of Ian Duncan Smith approach of punishing disabled people when we can see that the bankers are actually walking away with even bigger tax breaks, it looks like this year at Goldman Sachs, for example?
Well, they have to try and rein the finances in somewhere, and they're just looking for soft targets. They're looking for people that don't finance their lifestyles, people that they're not frightened of challenging. It's easy to pick on somebody who's disabled, isn't it, at the end of the day? This is a culture of victimisation. You look for the softest targets and you take money from them. That's precisely what's going on, and that's what I'm saying. We have a multi-tier Britain already.
This is really like dog eat dog. I mean, that's a pretty dark road to go down.
It already is that. I mean, we are in that dark road. That's why we see retail stores closing. We're here in my local town of Croydon. Alder's department store was one of the oldest department stores in the UK. It's now closed after 120 years of being in business or whatever. We are losing these things in the high street because the money's not there to spend. It's not there to spend because the banks have got it. We've given huge amount. I mean, let's not forget, Gordon Brown gave £1,000 billion, £1 trillion in bailout money to the banks. Yet this is a man who can't find £200 million, and to understand that, that's by a factor of 50,000. 1/50,000th of what he gave to the banks, he can't find for junior and primary school education. So you have to ask yourself the question, where does this guy find this enormous money to help out this small power elite to maintain their control system, which is what it is, and yet can't find a few quid here and there for people whose tax is being used to bail out this ultra uber wealthy group?
What about 2008 then? What would have happened if banks had been allowed to collapse? Surely that would have been horrific.
No, if Northern Rock had been allowed to collapse, that would have been one of the best things that would have ever happened in the UK. The dust would have settled probably 3 years ago by
now. But what about the bigger banks, RBS, Lloyds?
Well, it's arguable that by allowing the smaller ones to fail and the ones that should have failed when they failed to have failed, all the rest of the books would have balanced elsewhere. So that's my point. Northern Rock, the first round of bailout cash was $25 billion by Gordon Brown. That was then followed up by two further amounts after it's been nationalised to a total of £75 billion. Just the initial $25 billion, Northern Rock had 8,000 employees. So £25 billion represents £3 million more than per employee in the bailout. £3 million per employee. We'd have been better off laying them off and giving them £1 million each, and we'd have actually saved 16 billion quid from the public purse. But I think if we said to people we're going to give all ex-Northern Rock employees £1 million each, people's hair would have been on fire and they'd have been jumping up now saying we don't want that. But we actually have taken on £75 billion worth of Northern Rock liability. Should have just let it go.
So theft and robbery, this is the word picture you're painting, but the police haven't acted and nobody's really been arrested. One or two kind of token gestures.
Yep, token fines and paying fines before anybody goes into open court. That should never be allowed. A crime is a crime. Somebody goes out and rapes a woman and then they turn around and say, oh, we'll pay a fine to the FSA rather than face preferred charges. It's the job of the police to prefer charges and the Crown Prosecution Service where a crime has been committed. The evidence is in the public domain that this crime has been committed, not just the LIBOR, but I'm talking about all the other criminality that's gone on, because the government has behaved criminally in bailing out the banks. It had no right to do that. A system existed previously whereby the Bank of England was known as the lender of last resort. The Bank of England had open windows by which it was allowed to bail banks out. Once it reached those limits, No bank is allowed to receive any further money. Not only did the banks go over those limits, but Gordon Brown stepped in, as we just described with Northern Rock, and went massively over the failure window. They should have been allowed to fail like Barings was. But unfortunately, Gordon Brown's ego is the kind of man where he would not allow a failure to occur on his watch, because he wants everyone to think that he's the greatest living Chancellor of the Exchequer that history's ever seen. I did a review of his biography, his autobiography, and nearly every other page is how I saved the world. It's actually embarrassing to read it.
He did actually say that, Martin, didn't he, as well? Saved the world, Gordon Brown did. So that was Mohammed Rafiq there, former staffer at the Bank of England, giving us a fascinating, I think, inside view of it all, and explaining that this is really a family thing, Martin, that it's handed down from generation to generation. And even economists like you aren't actually aware of the nuts and bolts of how these things operate.
Well, in fact, I agreed with everything that was being said there, apart from the final point where he said, well, if we'd allowed the banks to go down, it would have been all right. I think that in actual fact, the problem is that if the banks had been allowed to go down, it wouldn't necessarily have been all right. And that is part, I mean, obviously you've got people like Gordon Brown who were so up themselves, they didn't even see it coming. And then, of course, want to take all the credit for rescuing things. And all of that is absolutely to the point. But the problem is that we're all implicated in this financial setup, and letting the banks go down, they are going to go down. That's what's ultimately going to happen. That's what I would say. It won't necessarily just sort itself out. It's likely to be chaotic.
I mean, I think his point is that now it's gone that much further down the line, it's going to be far worse than if it had happened in 2008. Yeah. Now, I mean, are you saying then that, say, if Northern Rock had been allowed to go down, it would have been like a house of cards, loads of other banks would have gone as well?
I think that
possibly
was
right up to the top.
Yeah, that's the fear.
A domino effect.
Yeah, I mean, because in 1998, long term capital management went belly up in the US, and they'd only been trading for 18 months, set up by Myron Scholes, who invented the derivative and so on, and they had to go in and bail it out because the whole financial system of the world would have collapsed on the basis of just one hedge fund. Now the problem is that they're all interlinked with everybody else, so of course they're then in a position to say, you'll have to bail us out, otherwise it's all going to go down. Now I take the point that this guy's an insider, and maybe he knows more than I do, and say, well, we could have let Northern Rock go down and the others would have been all right. I suspect otherwise. I think the problem is, with the best will in the world, is that we shouldn't have allowed any of this to happen in the first place. Well, now, if you are going to bail things out, you should then dismantle the banks in an orderly fashion. That's what should have happened. Northern Rock basically should have been dismantled in an orderly fashion. And of course, Gordon Brown was spending a long time saying, oh, we've not nationalised it. And of course, even though when we've taken over RBS and Lloyds and all the rest of it, the government hasn't asserted itself over those boards. It's said, oh, you carry on trading and eventually we'll sell you for a profit.
But his wider point there is that we're waiting for this train crash to happen. Nobody seems to be actually sort of trying to make sure it doesn't happen. Nobody really has got that plan B in place. Ready to actually, I suppose, if we're heading for a train crash, to change the points, you know, to send the train off up a hill into a safe little siding somewhere.
Well, that's what should have been happening. If you'd had a Labour movement prime minister of the old school, he would have seen the train crash coming, he would have recognised that the banks were overborrowed and all the rest of it, and they would have prepared a trap for them. So the moment they got into trouble, they said, aha, we knew you were in trouble, we're going to nationalise you all, crash, bang, wallop, we've nationalised the whole financial system.
And he would probably have had a team of directors to take over.
Yeah, well, exactly, the civil service should have been prepared and all the rest of it. And of course, you've got to prepare the population as well. You've got to keep attacking the banking system and saying, when they mess up, we are taking over. But of course, they were all completely taken by surprise by it, because they're all insiders. I mean, Brown and Blair were over before they got elected, schmoozing with the IMF, saying, hey, we're not going to be any problem. We may be Labour, but we're not going to cause any trouble for you.
It sounds like,
and
the
of course, that's the trouble, is we've allowed the financial sector to become untouchable.
I mean,
both
you and Mohammed Rafiq make the bailout sound like one of the biggest confidence tricks in history.
It was. It's like the sting. And they've just walked out of the back of the office with the money, and we're sitting there, what's going on? And of course, eventually people will wake up when it's too late. But it's very like the 30s, isn't it? You know, the stock market collapses in 1929, Hitler comes to power in 1933, everybody faffs about for years and years trying to solve the problem, but nobody really gets a grip on it, and then the real business starts happening
in
1939.
To be fair, he offered his sort of project management of the entire thing, and saying, well, look, this all really depends on whether the people that have committed fraud, the individual traders and the directors, not a sort of confusion about, oh, we can't arrest the traders, we ought to arrest the bank. But he's talking about both of them have committed fraud.
All of them.
All of them have committed fraud. Unless we have a police service that's actually prepared to do its job, it doesn't seem that we have, Martin.
Well, that's a question, isn't it? That is a question. And, of course, the other way to deal with it is the way the IRA dealt with it in the Bishopsgate bomb years ago. That one bomb they planted there knocked away all insurance for British businesses. And well, at that point...
But that's not a good
thing. No, I'm just pointing out that is, if you haven't got a police service that's prepared to do its job, others will do it. Will take whatever steps they feel are necessary. Now, the fact is, of course, that ultimately we should never have allowed this financial elite to develop this kind of power over us, and we're going to have to do something to stop them. And of course we would prefer to do that the nice way rather than the nasty way, but I'm afraid in the real world it's going to be a lot messier than that.
Okay, well, at what point do we get to the point of Greece with sort of riots in the streets? I mean, the thing is, even there they've still got their sort of technocrat government that wasn't even elected by the people. We've had another technocrat government coming in Eastern Europe, I think, isn't it, in Bulgaria this week?
Yes, and we're also getting false flag terrorist events which are being blamed on the radical movement in Greece, which are probably being orchestrated from inside NATO's secret services. So what we're up against is I wouldn't call it a fascist state, let's call it a mafia state. They're not actually that dogmatic about race or anything like that. They're just greedy, selfish, and criminal. And they've got to go to prison or something similar. That's what's got to happen.
So how come we've got the situation where there's a moral hazard for you and I walking down the street, and anybody, actually, if we steal a bottle of water, we go to jail? But these massive, massive... I mean, 70 to 80 trillion pound, he was talking about, to do with LIBOR there. Nobody goes to jail. It's just a little rap on the knuckles.
Yeah, all right.
There's no moral hazard in committing these crimes anymore.
Not at the moment. But on the other hand, I would say this, that in actual fact, the criminality of the elite is ultimately going to be their undoing. They're not just greedy, they are criminal. And that's what people have got to get through their heads. And eventually, of course, we will build an alliance with the right police officers, and we will get to the bottom of it. And that is how we will deal with it.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, coming up now to time to sign off, and we're very sorry I couldn't bring you Ian Fraser this week, who had to rush off and pick up some children because his wife couldn't, and we'll be having a chat to him next week. The reason I've invited him on is because he pointed out this fraud trial back in 1992, the Blue Arrow trial by County NatWest, really sent the signals right out across the whole of the City of London saying, it's okay guys, open season for fraud. So time to sign off. That's just the start of your Friday night talk radio extravaganza. Coming up next, the typical topical Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, former Trades Union Socialist Coalition candidate for Bristol Mayor, Tom Baldwin. And also you heard from Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and also for former Bank of England staffer Mohammed Rafiq. Next week, the ladies in the studio, possibly, for our final show before we break for International Women's Day in a fortnight. This...